This is a quote from A.W. Tozer, who died in 1963. But Tozer was an influential pastor, preacher, spiritual writer, really known for his one-liners. And this really sums up what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about idol worship, something that substitutes God in our lives. I'm going to look at the story of the golden calf in Exodus chapter 32. But the reality is, man was made to worship. I'll update the language a little bit for you. Humans were made to worship. We don't say things like man anymore. We say humans. We say humanity. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter who you are. You will worship. You will metaphorically lay down your life for something. You will give your time, energy, money to something. You will focus on something as a great hope, as a purpose, something that gives you meaning. You will do that because you're human. Worship is not a religious term. It's a human term. The question becomes, who will you worship, or what will you worship? What person or thing will you give your energy to, your thoughts to, your time to? The Christian claim is that anything outside of the one true God, it may be a God, small g, but anything outside of the one true God, capital G, will essentially fail. Everything else is just a substitution, what a Christian would call a false god or an idol. The golden calf story in Exodus 32 that we're going to look about today is a little bit of an odd story. I've got a picture here for you, a golden calf that the Israelites made and they lifted up and they looked to. This painting here is from Nicolas Poussin. He was a French artist in the 17th century. I like looking at old Renaissance art when we look at these things. And there you see the people of God, the people that have been delivered from Egypt, the people that have watched God do all of these incredible miracles, now turn to a calf made of gold that they made with their own hands, and they begin to worship it. They begin to sing praises to it. They've given their money to it. They've given their gold, their own finances, in order to build this idol. They party around it. They drink around it. They feast around it. They celebrate around this golden calf, despite the fact of what God has done. An idol, to sum it up for you quickly and easily, is something that we look to give us life, to give us love. It's something that we look to as our source of hope, and we draw from it as a life source. Because everyone's looking for life, right? Looking for meaning, looking for the good life. We believe in human flourishing. We want to be well-integrated people. We want to experience the fullness of life. We want to be mentally, physically healthy. We want to be healthy in our family relationships. So we look to something to draw that life from. And when we draw from something that isn't Jesus, then we call that an idol. Now we see this worship in everyday life. This isn't just a religious thing. I went faithfully to the football yesterday and watched my team St Kilda lose as they usually do. And there's 40,000 people there worshiping sports stars, worshiping athletes, you know, lifting their hands, singing, dancing, clapping, waving flags, all these kinds of things. There's nothing wrong with the football. There's nothing wrong with money. There's nothing wrong with all of these things. But as the great Tim Keller says, humans always make this error. We make good things ultimate things. We make something like going to the footy or following the footy or a sports star or a pop star or money or work or family or our kids or our wife or our body and our clothes, whatever it is. We make good things, normal human things, we make them ultimate things, and we lift them up to be worshipped, and we look at them to draw our source of life and meaning and purpose from. And this is what we see in the story here. If you haven't been tracking along with us, we've been reading the book of Exodus as a church. So I've read almost, we're into the last phase now of our reading. I think we've got a table here showing the last few weeks of the chapters we've read, the sermons that we've done there. So we're up to number 7 today. I'm going to talk about idol worship. If you haven't done any of these readings, why don't you jump in tomorrow and do chapter 26 to 40 with us? This is the last week of reading that we've got there. That should say 36. I just realized that. Did anyone pick that up over the last 6 weeks? I'm going 25 to 40. And as I'm preaching, I'm like, there's not 15 chapters this week. That should say 30. None of you saw that, did you? 35 to 40 we're going to read this week. So if you want to jump into Exodus 35 with us tomorrow, and we've followed through the story of God setting the people free, the Exodus, the great Exodus, this incredible story of God setting the Israelites free from slavery in Egypt. Interestingly, if you've been following the story in the sermons, and Pastor Pete picked this up last week when he shared, it's really all about worship. So the initial idea from God to Moses is to go and set my people free, go and say to Pharaoh, let my people go. We all know that, but we often forget the other half of the sentence. God actually said to Moses, go to Pharaoh and tell him, let my people go so that they may worship me in the wilderness. It was about worship. It was about who is number one in your life. Who is your God? And then God comes to deliver the people of Israel through the 10 plagues and many, many miracles. And the whole purpose of God's intention with the miracles was so that the people of Israel could see that I am the Lord and that I have delivered them. And through my mighty hand, I have set them free. It was all about, I'm God, I'm here, I'm powerful, come and worship me. And then God offers the people of Israel a covenant through the 10 commandments. And the covenant is really about right worship, right relationship with God. And God shows the people how if you worship me in this way and approach me in this way because I am a righteous and holy God and you worship me in the right way, then we're going to have the right relationship. It requires obedience from you and it requires me blessing you. It requires you following my laws and decrees and then I will give you life and life to the full. The first commandment, the second commandment are to do with worship. Have no other gods before me. The second commandment, which we spoke about in week 5 there, that you shall not make an idol of any image or anything in the heavens or on the earth or in the sea. Verse 5 of chapter 20, you must not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a... Come on, Sunday school children. I, the Lord your God, am a... jealous God. Good answers. Well done. I'm a jealous God. God tells them why he wants them to worship him because I love you. I'm in covenant with you. I don't want you to run away to anyone else. Actually, later in the Old Testament, when God talks about idol worship, he calls it prostitution because he sees it as Israel running to another lover where he loves them. He wants to protect them. He wants to be with them. He doesn't want to be cheated on. He wants our hearts to be for him and him alone. But then we come to chapter 32 and we'll read it in a moment. And again, it's about worship. But this time they turn away from God and they turn to this man-made image and they begin to give their time, effort, energy and worship towards that. Let's pick it up in verse 1 of Exodus 32. I'm going to read the 20 verses about this. So if you want to pull out your Bibles for the four people that brought their Bibles, the rest of you can, that was a joke. The rest of you can watch along on the screen with me. Exodus chapter 32, verse 1. So when the people saw how long it was taking Moses to come back down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron. Come on, they said. Make us some gods, little g, who can lead us. We don't know what happened to this fellow Moses who brought us here from the land of Egypt. So Aaron said, well, take the gold rings from the ears of your wives and sons and daughters and bring them to me. All the people took the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. Then Aaron took the gold, melted it down, and molded it into the shape of a calf. When the people saw it, they exclaimed, O Israel, these are the gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Aaron saw how excited the people were. So he built an altar in front of the calf. Then he announced, tomorrow will be a festival to the Lord. The people got up early the next morning to sacrifice burnt offerings and peace offerings. After this, they celebrated with feasting and drinking and they indulged in pagan revelry. Verse 7, the Lord told Moses, quick, go down the mountain. Your people whom you brought from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They're not God's people anymore. Did you notice that? They're Moses' people. How quickly they have turned away from the way I commanded them to live. The good life, the right way. They have melted down gold and made a calf. They have bowed down and sacrificed to it. And they are saying, These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Then the Lord said, I have seen how stubborn and rebellious these people are. Now leave me alone so my fierce anger can burn against them and I will destroy them. Then I will make you, Moses, into a great nation. But Moses tried to pacify the Lord his God. Oh Lord, he said, why are you so angry with your own people whom you brought from the land of Egypt with such great power and a strong hand? Why let the Egyptians say their God rescued them with evil intention of slaughtering them in the mountains and wiping them from the face of the earth? Turn away from your fierce anger. Change your mind about this terrible disaster you have threatened against your people. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You bound yourself with an oath to them, saying, I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars of heaven. I will give them all of this land that I have promised to your descendants, and they will possess it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the terrible disaster he had threatened to bring on his people. Verse 15. Then Moses turned and went down the mountain. He held in his hands the two stone tablets inscribed with the terms of the covenant. They are inscribed on both sides from front to back. These tablets were God's work. The words of them were written by God himself. When Joshua heard the boisterous noise of the people shouting below them, he exclaimed to Moses, it sounds like war in the camp. But Moses replied, no, it's not a shout of victory nor the wailing of defeat. I hear the sound of celebration. When they came near the camp, Moses saw the calf and the dancing, and he burned with anger, and he threw the stone tablets to the ground, smashing them at the foot of the mountain. And he took the calf they had made and burned it. Then he ground it into powder, threw it into the water, and forced the people to drink it. What an epic story. Why do we turn to idols? Why do we turn to something else other than God? Let's go back to that Tozer quote. When was man was made to worship God? Humans are made to worship, to idolize something. Any substitute for God will fail. If you've read the story here, or you caught it as I read through it this morning, the problem starts with Moses up the mountain. The people grow impatient. Where is this guy Moses who led us out of Egypt? And I think this shows us a first reason why people often turn to idols. A lack of restlessness, a frustration, a sense of where am I going? Who's going to help me? Who do I reach out to? They've just been delivered from Egypt. Moses is this great leader, but very quickly, he's a few days up the mountain. They haven't seen him. They don't know what's going on. So very quickly, they grow impatient and turn from the invisible God and make their own image a visible God. Secondly, we hear that they're looking for a leader. Aaron, make us a calf that can lead us. And then Aaron makes the calf and they say, this calf, this God, this is the Lord who brought us out of Egypt. As much as we may not like to admit it, we're all looking for a leader. We're looking for someone to take us forward. We're looking for something to give us purpose, to tell us the way to go. And as the people grow restless, and remember they're famous, these Israelite people, for grumbling, as they grumble, as they critique God, critique the commands, critique Moses, now they say, well, we don't have a leader. Let's make our own leader. Let's make our own way forward. Let's turn to this idol who will tell us what to do and where to go. And this is often what we do as humans with idols. We look for something or someone that resonates with us, and then we go in that direction. But whenever it's a substitute for God, that direction will always be a dead end. And then finally, there's celebration, joy, feasting around this idol. I think this is really, really interesting because as humans, we love to party, right? We love to have food. We love to have a dance. Again, good things. Nothing wrong with those things. But when we do it and when we make these things an ultimate thing, when we make this thing idol worship, then the party turns into pagan revelry, so the Bible tells us. I think this tells us something interesting about God. He wants us to have fun. He wants us to celebrate. We're going to come here for Passover Thursday night because we want to celebrate as a church. We want to eat food together. We want to spend time together before we all rush off for Easter. We want to stop and look to God. But who is at the center of the party is so important. What we eat and drink and party around is so important. Man is created by God in his image. But the moment that humans make God, small g, in their own image, they make something that's created sound like something that's the creator. They take something that's invisible, the invisible God, and make something that's visible, tangible, attainable, natural. Then this is where we've been seduced by an idol. God created man in his image. But when man creates a God in his own image, you've been seduced into a path that will not lead to life. This is what happens to the people of Israel. And God is ready to wipe them out. But who steps in? Moses. Moses, what a great leader. Rather than get on this, like, let's just kill these people. Yeah, they're a pain in my backside as well. Let's just deal with them. I'll start again, God. Yep, use me. Let's keep it clean. Let's start a new line, a new people. No, Moses steps into the position of intercessor. So between God and between the people down the mountain that are worshiping this idol, I mean, you imagine how offended Moses is feeling. Imagine how embarrassed Moses is feeling in the presence of God. This is ridiculous. All of these miracles you've done. You've fed us with manna from the sky every day so we wouldn't starve in the wilderness. And a few days later, a few days without any word from God or without seeing Moses because he's up the mountain, and so quickly their hearts are turning. God calls them stubborn and rebellious. You know, these stories aren't in the Bible, right, just to tell us historical facts. They're in the Bible to tell us about you and about me. We are inherently stubborn and rebellious. Yet Moses steps into the center as the mediator between heaven and earth, between God and the people. This is a sign that points us towards another mediator that will come. If you've ever read the book of Hebrews, there's this theme here. We can just jump to the next slide about Jesus being the mediator. Moses mediates, but we have a better mediator in Jesus. Hebrews 8:6 says, Jesus is the one who mediates a far better covenant for us. Everyone say better. And also far better promises. Everyone say promises. Better covenant, better promises. In Hebrews 9:15, it says that Jesus is the one who mediates a new covenant between God and the people. So what we see in Moses is a sign pointing towards Jesus who would come. And what we're going to celebrate this week with Easter is the fact, and we sang about it today with one of those songs, is the fact that Jesus stepped in, shed his blood on the cross, stepped in as a better mediator between us and God. Because we are stubborn, we are rebellious, we do turn so quickly away from God. None of us were good enough to play the role of mediator. Not even Moses was good enough, even though he was the greatest leader of the Old Testament. But Jesus is good enough. He's a better Moses. He brings us into a better covenant, the new covenant or the New Testament. And they're better promises that we receive from God. What I like about this story is how Moses shows us how to deal with idols. He burns the idol, the calf. He crushes it essentially into powder. It's a little bit odd. He throws it into the water and makes the people drink it. But what we see here, Moses, he took the calf in verse 20. They had made it, he burned it. Then he ground it into powder, threw it into the water and forced the people to drink it. What we see here is a dealing with idols, a dealing with how do we deal with this substitute that sometimes we get lured into putting this substitute for God, a false God. We deal with it quickly. We deal with it comprehensively. We crush it. The minute we see it, we crush it. We don't just put it out the back. We don't just put it to the side. We don't just have a break for a while. No, we ground it down into powder so that idol does not exist anymore. So the seduction of that idol, the promises that are not great promises that idol offers, the life that it offices, the substitute to God that it offices, is not even evident anymore. It's crushed down and made nothing. Moses makes them drink the water. The water's bitter. It's got crushed up gold dust on the inside, in it, this water. It's bitter. It's not good to drink. Because this is what idols are. They're bitter. Jesus gives water that is pure and clean. John 7, Jesus says, I've come to give you water, living water, rivers of living water. Cindy mentioned it before when she spoke about Jesus' own identification of himself as the bread of life. He is food that will quench your appetite, your hunger. He is drink that will quench your thirst. When we come to Jesus, like we heard from Susan today, we declare that Jesus is Lord. That statement, very simple statement, Jesus is Lord. Let's say it together. Ready? One, two, three. Jesus is Lord. That's essentially what it means to become a Christian. That's what Susan said, and we'll say next week when she gets baptized, Jesus is Lord. When we say Jesus is Lord, we say that he is King, he is ruler, he is God of my life. Jesus isn't an add-on to make your life better. Jesus isn't a solution because you're going through some anxiety issues or you're not sure how to parent your kids or you've had some trouble with money. Now, when you say, I'm following Jesus, he becomes Lord of everything, ruler, king, everything. Tozer again, man was made to worship, any substitute for God will fail. The minute you substitute Jesus as Lord and put something else as Lord, you'll always have a Lord of your life. Everyone's being formed and shaped by something in this world. There's something telling you to think. There's something leading you forward. We need a leader. But every one of those that are a substitute for God will fail. If Jesus as Lord of your life is substituted, it doesn't matter how much you come to church, how much you pray, how much you read the Bible, how Christian you sound or look, none of that matters. If there's something sitting on the throne of your heart that is not King Jesus, it will fail. As we head towards a bit of an end this morning, in about 10, 15 minutes, we're going to get up again with the worship band and we're going to sing. And I'm going to give you an opportunity today. Before I send you off, I'm going to give you an opportunity today. You might want to get on your knees and bow and worship the one true God. You might want to come out the front here and bring idols or things that tempt you away from God and bring them out and just crush them into dust out the front here. I'm going to give you an opportunity today to transact with God. Because just like God was with the Israelites, he's the same with you. He's created a new covenant with you through Jesus Christ, and he loves you. And he is fiercely jealous for you, and he doesn't like to be cheated on. And if you've said Jesus is Lord, then you've committed yourself to following Jesus and him and no other. If you're sitting here and you don't have a relationship with Jesus, you haven't said that, well, all of this stuff doesn't apply to you. That's fine. You just take your time. You work out whether Jesus is God or not. And that's your time. God gives you that space to choose. But if you've said yes, then the game begins to change. If you're looking for Jesus, you're not sure. If you are a Christian, you're following him. Let me explain to you why we get stuck with idols. There's four what I'm going to call meta desires. Meta meaning big, overarching, comprehensive, very broad categories here. But we tend to substitute things for God and worship other idols because we want to fulfill these desires: power, approval, comfort, control. Now, different Christian authors over the years have called these different things. They might be called desires, they might be called loves. Jonathan Edwards, the great Christian writer, used to call these the affections of the heart, the affections, the things that you love. Today, to use more modern language, we may call them appetites, inclinations. Well, a lot of these things we even call human rights today, that you should have these things and no one could tell you you can't have these things. And anyone who stands in the way of you getting these things any way that you want is trying to tell you what to do, and that's a bad thing. So whether they're loves, desires, affections, appetites, needs, or human rights, again, these are not a bad. These are good things. But when they become ultimate things or they replace God, then they become bad things. Jonathan Edwards called them disordered loves. or ordered loves. The gospel orders the loves in our hearts correctly. When we say Jesus is Lord, he begins to work in our life to order the loves so they're right. So your footy team's in the right spot, your pursuit of money's in the right spot, your pursuit of friendships and comfort and approval and all the things that give you these desires of your heart, God orders them in the right spot. He doesn't take them away, but he cleans them up. This is what it is to be a Christian. To progress in the Christian life is to allow God to order the affections of your heart in a godly way with him at the top. But the moment God is not at the top, then there's something else that's giving you power, approval, comfort, and control. These are not bad in themselves, but the idols that we worship are a substitute to give you power, approval, comfort, or control. Power is when we use people or things to give us that sense of success rather than relying and waiting and trusting on the power of God. The Israelites could not wait 40 days for the power of God to move, so they took control of the situation. Comfort is when we indulge ourselves or we avoid hard things. Rather than relying on the Holy Spirit as our comforter or God to comfort us, we indulge in order to feel comfort, or we avoid in order to not do anything hard, the path of least resistance. You don't have to put your hands up for these things, but some of these things are going to hit your heart, all right? Control. We do everything ourselves because we don't want to wait for God's will to be done or seek what God's will is. We want to take control. We want to control our circumstances, people, what they think of us, our money, whatever it is. And then finally, approval is the fourth meta desire. We're desperate to feel accepted. And when acceptance comes from people or things, then our identity in Christ, Jesus is Lord of my heart, is removed, and we're looking to other things, people and things, to give us acceptance. Again, Timothy Keller, an idol is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you only what God can give you. We look to idols because they give us another promise. God has given us a promise, but we look for another promise. But these false gods give us empty promises, a fleeting sense of power or approval. Now, these things can be very obvious things, physical things that we struggle with. So it's sex, it's all the vices, right? Sex, gambling, drinking, smoking, all the outward things, you know, the classic things that we go to give us power, approval, comfort, or control. So no one really runs out there going, I want power. I want to be super comfortable. I want to control everything. No, these are the desires of our hearts, but they get fulfilled by things in our life, by another lover. As I said before, God actually terms the pursuit of idols as prostitution, a strong word, but he sees it as an intimate love. We look to crazy things, don't we, to feel this love, this other promise of love. People look to dogs, to animals, to cats, to fulfill their sense of comfort. People look to food, to people, to people's opinions, to fulfill this sense of love. And I think one of the most damaging things we can do is we look to our own children to give us these feelings of power, approval, comfort, control. And we put on our own children an idolization because they give us something that we're not getting from God, which is incredibly dangerous. And I know that's not how we want to raise our children. Idols offer us another promise, another lover, another source of life, whether it's our physical appearance, the clothes that we wear, the friends that we have, the access to restaurants or famous people that we have, the pop star, the movie star, the conspiracy theorist that we consume all of their YouTube stuff. Whatever it is, we consume these things looking for approval or comfort or life before we consume God. Let me tell you a common story about how we meet these meta desires through idols. I'm going to talk to you about some very respectable idols. Because many of us, you may be sitting there this morning thinking, well, I don't know, Pastor K, I don't know if I really fall into these categories. I'm not really a drinker, and, you know, I'm really trying to be a good person, and I'm here at church, and I'm reaching out to God. And I know we're all trying hard. I know we're all trying to move forward in our Christian walk. Most of the time, our idols are so respectable that we don't realize we have them. We've so well explained why we need these other things outside of God to give us peace, joy, hope, comfort, that we don't even know they're there. They're called blind spots. We've so well defended our position of our idols and why we need these things rather than God that we can't even see that we have idols. We get stuck in the lie of respectable idols. Let me tell you about this young man and his journey. Got a picture of him on the screen here to give you a bit of an idea. He's a good-looking young guy. He begins his life as a typical young man. His idols are what you would expect. He pursues sex, gambling, drinking, anything that makes him feel comfortable, makes him feel good. And he just fulfills every young man appetite that he has in any way he can. He uses people, he abuses people, he chases all of these things to feel good. But all of a sudden he begins to change. He becomes much more respectable in the eyes of his parents anyway, because he meets a nice girl, he begins to start a family, he gets a good job. But now what has happened is not the revelation of Jesus Christ and the changing of his ways because God has got a hold of his heart. No, a new idol has captured his affections. It's not that he's dealt with the idols of these physical appetites of sex, gambling, drinking, smoking, all these vices. No, now a more respectable idol of wealth, comfort through money, power through money, has come across his path. And society really approves of this pursuit. His parents are happy. He attracts a beautiful woman. They start a family. But the initial idol is only suppressed by a greater idol. But then after time, he gets a little bit restless and anxious. He wants to move on to even greater things. And now he gets involved in politics. He gets involved in the work of ideology, the culture wars, the arguments about who's wrong or right, and wars in other parts of the world, and he gets involved in marches in the street, rallies, and all kinds of political things. But now this new idol begins to even outgrow the family idol. Promiscuity and over-drinking and all those things are a long way in the past now, decades ago, but now it's the idol of ideology, of politics, that's captured the affections of his heart. But it looks so good. He gives to charities. He's a wealthy man now. He's a philanthropist. People look at him as a mentor. He mentors many young men in business. But there's an even greater idol that begins to capture his heart. And this is moral superiority, to be the ultimate good person. And society is very, very comfortable with who this man has become in his old age now. Very wealthy, wife, children, all of these things. But the idol now of moral superiority is fulfilling all four of these meta desires of his heart. He has power because of his money. He has approval in the business world and the political realms. He has incredible comfort in his lifestyle, and he can do anything, go anywhere, meets with the best people, eats at the best restaurants. And he has high control. All of the desires of his heart have now been met by very, very respectable idols. The apparent growth in his life as a human, or development as a man, that on the outside looks fantastic. He looks to be a mature, charitable, wealthy family man, but really it's just been one more respectable idol on top of the next respectable idol. His heart is still captured by an idol that will never give him true purpose, real meaning. It won't matter once he dies, all of these things. He still will struggle with hope. He'll still struggle with purpose. He'll struggle with anxiety. Even though he may have all things and know all people, he still does not know God, and therefore he never has really been able to know himself. Tim Keller again, we turn good things, family, money, work, charity, politics, being a good person, we turn good things, not bad things, good things, but we make them ultimate things as a substitute for God.